Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's mentor guest is Dr. Melanie Joy of Beyond Carnism and melaniejoy.org for a second conversation to expand our relational literacy by focusing on a term she coined called carnism. She coined this phrase in her 2010 best-selling book that was newly updated in 2010. Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows is what we're talking about today. Welcome to the program, Melanie. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Hi. Thank you. Great. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to talk with you. I just feel like I'm bumbling over my words, so I just want to say that and put it out there a little bit. But I would like to give the audience a little bit more background about you. You're a Harvard-educated psychologist specializing in relationships, communication, and social change. You're an award-winning author of 6 books, including Getting Relationships Right, How to Build Resilience and Thrive in Life, Love, and Work, which I think is a must-have relational dictionary that you will come back to many times to get ideas for how to deepen your relationships and really flourish in experiencing what resilient relationships feel like. You also have written Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, which is what we're talking about today. Dr. Joy is also an international speaker, trainer, and organizational coach. Her work has been featured by media outlets around the world, including the New York Times, the BBC, and ABC Australia, and she's been granted a number of international awards. You can learn more about her at melaniejoy.org, and you can also go to beyondcarnism.org and check out her content there as well. Both are very, very informative. So let's go ahead and get started. This is your first book, right?
It's actually my second book.
It's your second book. Okay.
It's my best-selling book. It's what I'm best known for.
And Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. You write about the psychology of eating animals. And I grew up on a dairy farm, and it's been a long journey. Earlier this year, January 15th, with my daughter's influence, she's asked if, based on her own research and what she's been introduced to with watching Cowspiracy and Seaspiracy and reading other materials, she asked if we could become vegan, you know, be more plant-focused. And I've been working toward that for about 20 years. But I have found that over the last 5 years in particular, there are lots of restaurants, vegan restaurants, that are popping up all over the place. And we can almost go to any restaurant now, and they have some options that are plant-based options. And maybe they're only one or two, but, you know, they're one or two. So, and they're one and two, and I think they're expanding. So I was wondering, does the work that you're doing relate to the work on relational literacy? And why did you decide to write such a powerful, novel argument for eating plant-based food books, which helped me to go into, like, I will never eat meat again. After reading your book, I just feel like I have an understanding of, in a relationship to a lot of the animals, and remembering, you know, some of the trauma that I experienced, I guess, growing up in a dairy farm that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah, I mean, so thank you, first of all. Thank you for your very kind words. So I'll start out by saying, you mentioned that the book was published in 2010, and we just released the 10-year edition in 2020, which was the 10th anniversary edition. And a lot's changed in the past 10 years. As you point out, there's, you know, been really an incredible growth of awareness around plant-based eating, around veganism. More and more people are, you know, really starting to reconsider their food choices. And this is for a number of reasons. I want to point out that this is really, it's very interesting. It's happening all around the world. I've been to over 50 countries talking about this issue. And without exception, everywhere I've been, you know, whether it's South Africa, Taiwan, Hungary, you know, South America, India, I hear the same thing, which is that plant-based or vegan, you know, awareness of veganism, plant-based or vegan options and organizations are just like really popping up everywhere. So this awareness is really growing tremendously. And I also just want to point out for people who want more information, it's carnism.org is our website. Beyond Carnism is the name of the organization.
Good. So, yeah, thank you.
So, and there's a lot of resources we have on there, short videos, you know, really, you know, quick snippets of information for people who want it, and then more information. So I wrote my book back in 2010. Originally, it emerged out of my own experience. I grew up with a dog who, many people in the West anyway, I grew up with a dog who I loved like a family member. And I also grew up eating meat, eggs, and dairy. And, you know, through the course of a lot of my life, I never thought about how strange it was that I could pet my dog with one hand, you know, while I ate a pork chop with the other, a pork chop that had once been an animal who was at least as you know, sentient or sensitive and intelligent as my dog. I just didn't make the connection. I was certainly a person who cared about animals and would never want to contribute to their suffering, especially when that suffering was so, you know, intensive and so completely unnecessary, you know, and yet I just didn't connect the dots. And it wasn't until 1989 when I ate a hamburger that was contaminated with a bacteria, Campylobacter, that landed me in the hospital, that I had a change of perspective. I was so sick that I just could never eat meat again. I couldn't eat meat again because I was disgusted by it, because it was the last thing I'd eaten before I had gotten so sick. And so in the process of learning how to cook for myself, you know, and eat as a vegetarian, I was kind of a vegetarian by accident back then, I inevitably stumbled upon information about animal agriculture, and what I learned shocked and horrified me. I could not believe the extent of the suffering of the animals. I couldn't believe, you know, the extent of environmental damage that was being done. And I was also learning about the impact, the negative impact on my own body, on human health, of animal agriculture and eating animals. And so, and this was back in the 80s, you know, before there was anywhere near the amount of research and literature that we have today demonstrating the damage done by animal agriculture in a animal-based diet. And so I became vegan at that point. And, I was really shocked, but what shocked me in some ways even more was that nobody I talked to about what I was learning was willing to hear what I had to say. They would tell me things like, you know, they'd say, "Don't tell me that, you'll ruin my meal," or they'd call me a crazy vegan hippie propagandist. They just shut down the conversation. And these were people who were like myself. They were rational, compassionate people, you know, really wanting to create a better world, people who cared about animals. And yet they just became incredibly defensive as soon as the issue of eating animals came up. And so this motivated me to do my research on the psychology, the psychosociology of eating animals, which was what led me to identify what I came to call carnism, which is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. So carnism basically conditions us to think of certain animals as edible and to feel and act accordingly. So for example, if you imagine that you are sitting down and you're biting into a juicy hamburger and your dining companion turns to you and says, "By the way, the meat in that hamburger is not from cows. It's from a golden retriever." Chances are what you had just thought of as food, you now can't help but think of as a dead animal. What you just felt was delicious, you now feel is disgusting. And rather than continue eating the hamburger, you want to throw it away and maybe even get up and protest to protect golden retrievers from being slaughtered for human consumption. Carnism conditions us to disconnect from our authentic thoughts and feelings when it comes to those animals we've learned to classify as edible. It distorts our perceptions so that we don't think of them the same way we think of other animals like dogs. So when we look at their flesh, we see food rather than a dead animal. And we feel and act accordingly.
Yeah, it reminds me of Oprah Winfrey once had a show on her Oprah show that she had for 25 years. And she was actually sued by the beef organization, one of them in Texas, because she was encouraging people to not eat so much meat. That was, right. You know, that was in the 90s, the power that and so she moved her whole show to Texas and she won the lawsuit because it was based on her freedom of speech. But she then hired an attorney to monitor all of her conversations to make sure that she's, you know, within the parameters of freedom of speech about certain topics. But, you know, when you talk about powerarchy, the power of the systems, and you talk about carnism and this invisible system that conditions us to disconnect, it's powerful. That's why it's invisible.
Right. And right. And to your point, you know, carnism is, it is an invisible system. So carnism has these, you know, certain properties to it that are really important to become aware of. Carnism is, first of all, it's a violent system. It's literally organized around violence. Meat cannot be procured without killing, and egg and dairy production cause extensive harm to animals. Most people would be deeply offended if they were truly connected with the reality of what is happening because of carnism. And yet most people support carnism, even though carnism runs counter to their core values, you know, of caring and fairness or compassion and justice, however you want to put it. Most people care about animals and would never, and the environment, and would never normally, you know, support a system such as carnism. Carnism is also what's called a dominant system. That means it's so widespread that its tenets, its teachings, essentially, are invisible. They're just woven through the structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, etc. It shapes the very way we think and feel about eating animals. And carnism is, because it is a dominant system, that means it's embraced and maintained by all major social institutions. So, for example, when we study nutrition, we're actually studying carnistic nutrition. Now, because carnism runs counter to our core values, it needs to use a set of psychological defense mechanisms that distort our perceptions and disconnect us from our natural empathy so that we act against our values without realizing what we're doing. So most people, you know, who were born into carnism, when we are born into such a widespread system such as carnism, we inevitably learn to look at the world through the lens of that system. We internalize the system. So we have all, because we've been born into this dominant system, we've all internalized this, what I call the carnistic mentality or this carnistic thinking. Carnism teaches us to feel resistant to any information that would get us out of the carnistic box that we don't even know we're in. So we tend to feel resistant to vegans, resistant to information about veganism, and highly defensive to any information that challenges what we perceive as our right to eat animals. And this makes the conversation about eating animals, you know, quite difficult. Let me give you an example of some carnistic defenses so listeners know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So carnism uses a defense called abstraction. It teaches us to see farmed animals as abstractions, as lacking in any individuality or personality of their own. So we learn, for example, to think of a pig, you know, that a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. These are psychological distancing mechanisms. They distance us from our natural empathy for these individuals. You know, we don't think this way about dogs because we haven't been conditioned to think this way about dogs. Or carnism teaches us to see farmed animals as objects So we learn to refer to the chicken on our plate as something rather than someone. Again, it's a distancing mechanism. Carnism teaches us to justify eating animals. And the way we learn to justify eating animals is by learning to believe in a vast mythology around eating animals. We learn to believe that the myths of eating animals are the facts of eating animals. So we learn to believe in what I refer to as the three M's of justification, that eating animals is normal, natural, and necessary. Of course, these same arguments have been used to justify violent practices throughout history, from male dominance to heterosexual supremacy. We don't question these myths. We don't question these justifications because we've just been taught that they're facts rather than a widely held set of opinions. So what happens is that because we've all internalized this carnistic mentality, we're not thinking for ourselves a lot of the time when it comes to eating animals. We don't recognize that we're making a choice when it comes to eating animals. We're just eating animals. It's just a given. It's just the way things are. So I wrote Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows in large part because I wanted to give people the opportunity to make their food choices freely. Without awareness, there is no free choice.
Yeah, that's such a powerful statement. Without awareness, there's no free choice. So if we can be aware of what we're eating and how the meat gets on our plate or touring, you know, even the lack of openness to how animals are processed is closed.
That's right. And it's awareness of the reality of what's happening because of carnism, the consequences of carnism. But it's also important to be aware of carnism itself, of this system that's basically hijacked our psyches and taken our freedom of choice from us by distorting our perceptions and so deeply conditioning us to follow its dictates, essentially.
Yeah. Because the journey to understanding and being aware of plant-based food and how we can get more of it and transition our different habits. Like it's been a whole process of, you know, grocery shopping, you know, where do I find different things, or replacing, looking at all the ingredients and looking at all the ways I prepare food. I mean, it's a big transition, and I found it it's really, really fun. It's finding new restaurants and that kind of thing. But what I appreciate in your book is this would be great for a book club. You've got the discussion guide in the back that's really helpful to talk about openly what people are experiencing and some of the concepts in your book and the carnistic defenses that you were just talking about and referring to. Can you explain how carnism is a global phenomenon? How do people around the world experience and practice carnism?
Yeah, sure. In meeting in cultures around the world, people learn to classify generally a small handful of animals as edible, out of the thousands of species that could be edible. They learn to classify a handful of those animals as edible, and all the rest get classified as inedible and often disgusting and even offensive to consume. So even though the type of species changes from culture to culture, people of all cultures tend to experience their own choices as rational and the choices of people of other cultures as irrational and often disgusting and offensive. So we all learn carnism because carnism is a global phenomenon. We're all socialized to relate to the animals that we eat in the same way, to desensitize ourselves from those animals we've learned to think of as edible. And to find so-called inedible animals as off-putting.
Exactly. If we know that this is happening globally, I mean, this is where you're so skilled at bringing it into, you know, a bigger context so that we can understand this isn't about, you know, just you and me. There's a larger invisible system going on here that's not helping us to connect. It's actually helping us to disconnect from ourselves, and therefore we're struggling in a lot of different areas in our life and entering coming into these different social situations, where, you know, how to navigate through that with all these beliefs that are out there that keep us from trying to connect without offending other people and feel, you know, so it's not about moral superiority. It's about how can we stay connected with people, but understand that we can have these deeper conversations to understand where we are in these invisible systems. Is that what you're saying with
yeah.
Yeah. When you're presenting the global phenomena?
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, people tend to, assume that, to make up stories about the choices of people from other cultures, or to make up stories about carnism itself and say, well, it's not really a social system because, look, I mean, sure, Melanie, you say we love dogs and eat pigs and wear cows here in the U.S., but what about in Korea, you know, and to sort of use that as a way to discount the presence. Sometimes people use the presence of dog eating, for example, in certain countries as a way to invalidate that carnism exists in the West. However, carnism exists everywhere. It's just the type of species consumed changes from culture to culture. So understanding this helps us better understand carnism, and it also helps us to be less judgmental of the food choices and, you know, of people of other cultures, because we're all conditioned, you know, within this global system to think and feel and act in certain ways.
And carnism seems similar to some other isms like sexism and racism. How is carnism connected with them?
Well, it's important to first say that the experience of each set of victims of these systems, these problematic systems, I call them non-relational systems, they're systems of oppression. The experience of each set of victims will always be unique. The structure, however, of the systems is the same, and most importantly, the mentality that drives the oppression is the same. The same mentality that causes us to relate to non-human animals in a dysfunctional way that leads to harm to them and often to ourselves as well, is the mentality that causes us to relate to different human groups in this non-relational way. And in our last podcast, we talked about relationality versus non-relationality. And I talked about how when we look at the problems, the most pressing problems in our world, also in our personal lives, but here we'll talk about systems in our world, like patriarchy and racism, war, poverty, animal exploitation, speciesism, climate change, and so on and so forth. They share a common denominator, and this common denominator is relational dysfunction, which is dysfunctional ways of relating, whether it's between social groups, between human groups, between humans and non-human animals, between individual humans, or even in the way that we relate to ourselves. All of these systems reflect relational dysfunction, meaning that we are relating in ways that cause harm and lead to disconnection and insecurity in our systems. And therefore, I have suggested that a common solution, one part of the common solution to the many of the problems we have in our world, is building what I call relational literacy, which is the understanding of and ability to practice healthy ways of relating. The groups change, like who is oppressing whom changes, but the process, the way that we express and the mentality, the way that we oppress, the mentality of oppression stays the same. So when we're talking about, you know, when I'm talking about carnism is a non-relational system. It is a system that conditions us to relate to farmed animals, in this case, in a way that results in harm, disconnection, insecurity, and ultimately I'm talking about harm. And so it's really important to appreciate that the same mentality that causes us to, that drives us to harm other humans, drives us to harm non-humans. And I'm saying too much in a short period of time, but hopefully the general point is coming across.
Oh, for sure. Like if we bring integrity into every aspect of our lives and we look at it from a place of do no harm, You know, how can I not cause harm? It doesn't mean not communicate about important issues, but how can we, like, even if you're setting up a gathering in a work environment, how can I be aware of bringing more plant-based food in here? How can I bring integrity and comfort into the way in which we all can eat in a non-harming way?
Right. And it's just, it's really about how, as we talked about in our last segment, you know, how can we bring more integrity into our minute-to-minute interaction? Because this is really the core of healthy relationality is the practice of integrity. It's the practice of respect. It's asking, if I were in your position, how would I want you to be treated? Whether we're talking to somebody who happens to be a pig in a slaughterhouse or who happens to be another human, you know, who is going to be impacted by some of our choices. If we can answer this question, you know, honestly and act accordingly, we can create a much more relational, kinder world for all of us.
Excellent. And all of Melanie's work is designed to raise awareness of the obstacles that are preventing people from interacting in ways that create a sense of mutual connection with human and non-human beings. These obstacles are both internal, which are psychological, and external, which are social. And they are a crucial reason why we act against our own interests and the interests of others, often without realizing that we're doing so. So with awareness, we can think freely and act compassionately to create healthier and more fulfilling relationships and a more equitable and sustainable world. That's what all your work is through your international organization. They can go to carnism.org. Your movement and your business is Beyond Carnism. So it's an international organization. Are you still U.S.-based?
Yep, we're a U.S.-based international NGO.
Okay. And you're dedicated to exposing and transforming carnism, the invisible belief system that conditions us all to eat certain animals. And it's a global movement. And carnism causes extensive suffering. Just to give you a fact as we close out our conversation, animal agriculture is responsible for the unnecessary slaughter of 72 billion land animals and between 1 and 3 trillion fish and other aquatic animals worldwide per year. It's a major contributor to environmental degradation, human disease, and human rights violations. However, the majority of people who eat animals are unaware that they're contributing to such destruction. And the reason we're talking about this is to create, you know, a large awareness and for you to find a way to deeply connect with yourself and bring in integrity into all your interactions with people. Thank you, Melanie. Are there any other closing thoughts that you feel you would like to mention before we finish?
We covered so much. So I think that's it. And, you know, it's really just encouraging listeners here. If this is new to them, you know, it's new information to really try to not think of this, I'm not saying that, or to try to think of this issue as something that you can lean into and move toward, right? I always encourage people who are really interested, you know, and they're saying, oh my, I want to learn more, you know, come to carnism.org. We've got a lot of information there. And I encourage people to just try to be as vegan as possible, you know, each time, rather than saying to yourself, I have to go vegan now. If you want to do that, great. But if that feels like it's too much for you, then just each time you sit down to a meal, ask yourself, how vegan can you make this meal? And, you know, you will probably find that it doesn't take terribly long for you to have leaned into a new lifestyle.
Yeah, or even looking at your plate and saying, you know, I wonder if I could have half my plate of vegetables today, you know. So you've got so many great suggestions. And also, I encourage everyone to buy the book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. These are, you know, these are systems that we've been born into. They take a lot of processing to figure out and unpack what we were taught, how we feel about it, and then how we want to shift without going through a lot of overwhelm or feeling, you know, you can break this up. up into different pieces like Melanie's talking about it and just decide to, you know, just create an awareness, maybe even noticing, you know, how many plant-based people are in your inner circles. So there's lots of different ways you can think about it. Thank you so much for creating an awareness for us, Melanie. I just really appreciate your work and all that you're doing to make all of us a better people.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for what you're doing with your awareness raising and helping to get important messages out there into the world as well. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks, Mike Abea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And we'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.